This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Today, U.S. jets are pounding the Taliban front lines around Kabul, and our leaders say that the military offensive won't stop for the holy month of Ramadan, about 3 weeks from now. So when will it stop? According to the Powell Doctrine, we shouldn't go to war without overwhelming force, clear public support, and goals so clear we can meet them and get out. President Bush has America's support for now, but what exactly is the goal and the exit strategy? Should we, can we, know our way out of this war as we go in? Tonight, we'll look at the role and place of the exit strategy in the war on terrorism. First, the latest developments in Afghanistan. Earlier, I talked to Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post. He told me that the military battle is also a political high-wire act.
I think they're having a difficult time. I think it's more difficult than a lot of outsiders expected. But remember that they keep on saying, in almost every chance they get, officials say this is not a conventional war. This is not a linear war. They really are assessing the ground situation, then saying what's our next military step, and letting the politics on the ground determine what they do militarily. Now, this is kind of Colin Powell's nightmare, as it is the nightmare of any Vietnam vet, but you're fighting a war here, which is very much a guerrilla war influenced from the air by the United States.
So what are the opposing kind of forces here in terms of hurry up or wait for the politics? What are the pressures to hurry, and what are the political dictates?
There are two major pressures to hurry. One is that winter is coming in Afghanistan, and you could get a humanitarian disaster if you have a civil war and refugee flows continuing into the winter. The other is, of course, it's harder to conduct military operations, but that goes for all sides. So, and I think the United States has a technological advantage. The other thing hurrying them along is Ramadan, the Muslim holy month that begins in about 3 weeks, the middle of November. On the other hand, you don't want to just jam it into place, let the Northern Alliance from the north take Kabul. They've been there before. They had Kabul before, and the place was a moonscape. You want to balance out the interest of the major nations along Afghanistan's border. On the north, you have Uzbekistan and the other stands. On the west, you have Iran, and on the southeast, you have Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Of those, Pakistan is the one most important to us. It's the one that's put out the most for the United States in helping it in this situation. It's the one that has the most to lose if you destabilize the regime. And it's the one we have the most to lose from if you destabilize the regime, because they have nuclear weapons.
And they want to see Pashtuns in Kabul, at least in part.
Exactly. They have historically, these are their ethnic brothers across the border. They've historically supported Pashtuns in Afghanistan. And they want to see Pashtuns part of a future Afghan government.
India and Iran line up with the Northern Alliance more closely?
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
And as do all the former Soviet republics in Central Asia.
There's a lot of brave talk about getting this balance right, but what's your sense inside the Pentagon is the level of confidence that this very tricky balancing act politically can be pulled off?
The Pentagon's being very, very quiet about the situation right now. I think they are worried strategically, mainly about undermining Pakistan. The longer you carry on here, the longer you do military action through Pakistan, the greater a chance of destabilizing Pakistan. And if you take care of Afghanistan but mess up Pakistan in the process, you have not made a strategic gain. They're very conscious of that. So they're trying to take steps to compensate for the effect on Pakistan. And they are, what the United States government is doing, things like increasing economic aid, dropping sanctions, and downplaying issues about proliferation for the moment.
Tom, we hear from the Pentagon almost every day that things are going well and according to plan, but you've also written persuasively about the nightmare scenarios that flit around the edges of this scene and that are very real concerns. You just mentioned the potential destabilization of Pakistan. What are some of the broader pictures that concern military analysts inside and outside the Defense Department?
Well, this is a really strategic high-wire act. Things could go badly wrong. Everybody's concern begins with Pakistan. Pakistan does have nuclear weapons, and if you destabilize Pakistan, if it's taken over by Islamic extremists, that's a bad situation in the United States. It gets worse, though, because India would be very upset by any sort of situation like that. In the United States government, every time at war games, an Indian-Pakistan standoff, the war game results in a nuclear exchange. Then the world looks and says, well, maybe this is. It's beginning to look like a war against Islam if the Hindus are piling in on the Muslims, too.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate nightmare scenario is if everything really goes wrong successively several times, you wind up with the prospect of a pan-Islamic extremist state that encompasses several Islamic areas from, say, Saudi Arabia to Pakistan that has a big chunk of oil and has nuclear weapons.
That presumes some kind of unrest right across the region in Saudi Arabia, maybe even all the way to Egypt, that would leave a kind of Islamic government, one government potentially in charge across the entire region?
You do get a whiff of the old domino theory in Southeast Asia from when we were children and people talked about Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That if Pakistan goes, what else goes? If Pakistan becomes an Islamic extremist state, as Iran was for a period, who do they start supporting? Where do they start training terrorists? Do they start sending out people with money and weapons? Do they then seek to undercut Arab states that are friendly to the United States, such as the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia?
So with these concerns as a backdrop, how does that help us interpret the way that the Pentagon is addressing the situation right now?
Well, I think it underscores why they're being so careful about how Kabul is taken, that it's not simply the Northern Alliance going in and taking it over. They're being very careful about not stepping on Pakistan's toes, about making sure that Pakistan's concerns about the ethnic Pashtuns of southeastern Afghanistan, that those concerns are listened to and addressed. I think what you're going to see is some sort of deal where the Northern Alliance is allowed to move south, but not actually to take Kabul itself. And instead, they'll try to put some sort of Islamic-led international peacekeeping force into Kabul as kind of a Kabul security force, not for the whole country, but you could put some sort of security force into Kabul simply to make it kind of an international demilitarized city while a interim government is arranged.
And then what about the Taliban? Must it be defeated, or is it simply dislodged and brought back in another way? And if it has to be defeated, how would that happen? We hear the Northern Alliance is not exactly crack troops.
No, they're not crack troops in our sense. At the same time, they probably are the most patient, long-suffering, and enduring soldiers that the world has ever known, the Afghans. But I think what we've been doing with our raids is really to try to take apart the pillars of the Al-Qaeda terrorist network and also the pillars of the Taliban leadership, to decapitate is the term the military uses, to decapitate the regime without destroying the entire regime, so that there are some Taliban elements left over that can be part of a future government.
So does that mean it has to be vanquished on the battlefield, or is the hope that it disintegrates somehow and parts are incorporated into the next iteration of the Afghani government?
I don't think the United States government really cares as long as there is a replacement government. If somebody wants to go and vanquish them on the battlefield, I think the United States government would be our guest. I do not think a ground war is in the cards, at least the cards we see now, involving United States troops in any large numbers.
Tom Ricks is military correspondent for The Washington Post. U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has already warned the American people, don't expect a quick end to this war. Think about a war that could continue through our lifetimes. Are you prepared for a war with no end? Do we have a choice? Joining us this evening is John Lynn. He's professor of military history at the University of Illinois. Professor Lynn has taught warfighting strategy at the Marine Corps University in Quantico, Virginia. He's currently finishing The Mind of War, A History of War and Culture. Good evening, Professor John Lynn.
Good evening.
Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
And here in our studios is our guest news analyst, Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and professor of economics and social policy at Brandeis University. Welcome, Professor Reich.
Well, thank you, Tom.
How will the United States know when it's won the war on terrorism? Can we live without an exit strategy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Lynn, we're happy to have you this evening. You've been very articulate at pointing out that the rush for an exit strategy may not always be what a particular situation requires. Americans have been conditioned to expect one, but is it appropriate to hunger for an exit strategy this time?
I've always found the concern with exit strategies to be a little bizarre. I mean, it's as though one gets in a war because one knows one can get out of it at any time. I understand entirely about our desires to avoid mission creep, to getting into a situation where you become more deeply committed and your goals change and suddenly you've got Somalia all over again. The key thing about an exit strategy is the whole notion that your commitment is limited, and consequently, you don't want to get taken in farther than you really want to go. But that brings up the whole question of when you get into a war, you're hurting people and you're destroying things and you're doing violence. And you have to ask yourself, you know, how limited can your commitment be and yet still be willing to do that kind of havoc to an enemy? And my attitude is that we spent so much time talking about exit strategies and zero loss that we've started to fight a very funny kind of war. Now, I said started to. I think we stopped on the 11th of September because I don't think this is war has anything to do with those things. So consequently, when people start talking in terms of exit strategies about this war against the phenomenon of terrorism and particular terrorists, I think they're missing the point.
So in this instance, when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff talks about a war that may go on for a lifetime, that certainly suggests a different strategy. What strategy do you see emerging?
Well, I think it's going to be long. I think it's going to be frustrating. I think also it's going to be pulsating. I think we're going to see a war, and right now we're involved in combat in Afghanistan. That may be resolved. Gosh, I hope it will be fairly soon, or, you know. But then it goes to another thing. I mean, right now we're terribly worried about one kind of terrorism and one sort of terrorists. It's going to be different elsewhere. I would say, you know, when you find and locate terrorists, terrorist cells, one captures or kills, you pressure, defeat, or perhaps overthrow governments that clearly support terrorism. You actively pursue domestic and foreign intelligence. You take reasonable internal and external steps to limit the effects of terrorism without sacrificing fundamental liberties. And then you develop the kind of patience we're not famous for. But I have reason to believe that we will be able to muster the kind of patience that this long and ill-defined struggle will require.
Robert Reich, what about it? Americans are not famous for their patience, and they've been specifically tutored by their own military leaders, including former General Colin Powell, now Secretary of State, that they should look for clear goals, they should look for overwhelming force, and the expectation of an exit strategy seemed implicit in all that. Do you think the country, the culture, is prepared to entertain a different kind of war?
Well, I think the country right now, 6 weeks beyond September 11th and experiencing an anthrax scare, the country is absolutely committed and resolved to doing something about terrorism. But the interesting and important question here, and I'd love to have John Lynn's response to this, is how do you know when we've won? What's the measure of success? When do we know that, in fact, we have rooted out terrorism? The president said on September 25th, I don't care how long it takes to root out terrorism, we're going to do it. Well, if that is decades or a lifetime, how do we hold the military accountable for achieving any degree of success?
John Lynn, what about that? Part of the value, I suppose, of an exit strategy is that it created a moment at which we could appraise what we had accomplished. So what about it? How do we assess our success or failure here?
Well, this isn't an argument between, you know, my point of view and exit strategies, because as you just said, an exit strategy involves an evaluation that you've gotten to where you need to go anyway. I mean, look, you know, I see an analogy with the kinds of struggles that have gone in South Asia for a long time. You learn that some things cannot be, you know, won with parades. They have to be managed in the long run. And you know when you've won, maybe, you know, after, a good deal after you've won, when the threat diminishes to the level where you consider it far more tolerable. We aren't going to, you know, arrest Osama bin Laden, put him on trial, and declare victory. Because I think what we're dealing with here is both a cause and a mode. And the cause is one thing right now. It'll change into other things, and the mode will be used by other causes. We have to demonstrate that we can deal with that. And again, I rather think we're going to be able to do this. I don't want to get into a whole other topic here, but you know, we often say, and this is one of my lines, that if we do the wrong thing in Afghanistan, we become our enemy's best recruiter. That by using violence too much and the wrong way, you demonstrate that the enemy is right, and you create enough victims that in that sense of victimization, you get recruits for the other side.
John Lynn, we've got to take a quick break here. We'll be right back. Listeners, we're talking about an endpoint, if there is an endpoint, or what kind of an endpoint we can imagine for this war on terrorism. Are you prepared to walk into a war that may last a lifetime? Do you think we can be effective at that? Can we hang together at that? Is it necessary? Is it the right thing in cultural or military terms? Let us know. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage on WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about imagining an endpoint to the war on terrorism. Is there, can there be, an exit strategy? Our guests this evening are John Lynn, professor of military history at the University of Illinois. Professor Lynn taught war fighting strategy at the Marine Corps University in Quantico, Virginia. We're also joined by our guest news analyst this evening, Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor and now a professor at Brandeis University. We'd be happy to be joined by you as well. What's your view? Do Americans need an endpoint? Do we need an exit strategy to fight effectively? Or can we just wade in and follow this war wherever it takes us? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Lynn, just before the break, you were talking about the different circumstances of this war. And Robert Reich had raised, well, how do we stay accountable without an endpoint? How do we know when we've won? President Bush has said that our goal is to rid the world of evildoers. It's a noble and great goal, and Lord knows we don't want people blowing up buildings here, but it's so vast. How do we define this goal in a way that we can accomplish it and move on? Or can that happen?
Okay. You stepped on one of my best points here, which does apply to this, and that is, you know, first of all, I don't like the word of accountability here. Why? Well, on the one hand, of course, people have to be, you know, accountable. People have to show progress. But on the other hand, this is not an accounting problem. We're not counting beans, and we're not counting heads, and we're not counting bodies. We are trying to accomplish something. And I also think the notion that we are choosing to do this strikes me again as a little strange. I mean, what alternative do we have? My argument has often been that the worst, that we are two bad scenarios. One is to do the wrong thing and the other is to do nothing. But if I could just finish what I was saying before just for a second, and that is that just as by our, you know, by handling it poorly, we recruit for the other side. Every successful terrorist act re-recruits our commitment. And that's when I say it's a pulsating war. I mean, not only that we'll go from, you know, one theater of counter-terrorist activity to another. But also, I think it's reasonable to expect that our commitment will rise and fall. I don't think it'll ever disappear, but I think it will rise and fall. As Professor Reich was saying, here we are, we're early in the stages, and it's very often that early in the stage of a war, there's a tremendous commitment of Americans, and then they tire. What I see here is that there's a kind of return to that commitment every time the enemy is successful. If the enemy is not successful, and in fact, if the terrorist acts decline, then what you've essentially got is a kind of victory. Okay. So my guess is as long as there's a reason, there will be a commitment.
We're joined now by Charles McLaughlin. He's a former Special Forces officer and Green Beret team leader. He's now a consultant to Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Charles McLaughlin, as a former military officer, how important was it or is it to you to see a clear exit strategy for the troops?
Well, when we talk about exit strategies, we have to talk about two things. We're talking about the Afghanistan theater, one, and two, the broader war on terrorism.
Yes.
For the Afghanistan theater, I think it's very important. It's very important to know what it is that we're trying to accomplish. As Professor Lynn stated so well, the history of warfare is one where states go into wars very enthusiastically but not thinking through what it is we're to accomplish. So in Afghanistan, it would be good to hear a clear articulation of the end goals. Now, I think there are three goals that are clear. First of all, we want to kill or capture bin Laden. We want to destroy the al-Qaeda network, and we want to overthrow the Taliban. But what next? And probably what's really important is to keep Afghanistan from becoming a base for terrorists again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something what has to be thought through, how we're going to accomplish that.
As a military man, when you listen to the briefings coming from the Pentagon, do you feel the level of clarity that you would like around the Afghanistan mission?
Well, of course, I'm not in the service right now. I would say that if I were in the service, I would feel confident. My friends who are currently serving do feel confident. I think that they're sending out the messages that are very well received in the ranks.
And what's the impact on the military of this notion that though Afghanistan is the current mission in theater, it may just be one in a series of theaters that have to be addressed? How does that work on the morale and expectations of troops and officers?
Well, I think that morale and expectations couldn't be higher right now. I think there's great enthusiasm for, not to be overly emotional, but to follow the example of the firemen and policemen that we saw do their duty. And I think that the ethos within the military is one that very strongly wants to do that. I just returned from my 15th class reunion at West Point, and that was very much the mood. Those of us who are out of the service were wishing that we were back in. Those that are in are feel that they're doing something important. And I think that's the thing now that the military probably appreciates a great deal, is feeling that they are doing something important. I think that sense was lost for several years, and it's obviously back. There's, we have a case where people are attacking the American homeland. It could obviously be concluded that people are continuing to plan to attack the American homeland, and that needs to be stopped.
Charles McLaughlin, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome.
Robert Reich, there you see perspectives laid out that really are accepting the notion of a fairly open-ended commitment, the desire for more concrete goals in Afghanistan itself, but the understanding that the general framework here is very broad and has no endpoint. How does it strike you?
Interestingly, Tom, the Colin Powell doctrine, now when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Gulf War, he made very clear that he thought that we should, when we were entering into any kind of a military stance, there had to be a vital national interest in jeopardy and a clear, achievable goal. And I want to emphasize that part of the Powell Doctrine, a clear and achievable goal. And what we're talking about here, at least as it has been enunciated by our political leaders and by our military leaders, doesn't seem all that clear. Getting rid of terrorism. It's not just about replacing the Taliban in Afghanistan. It's not just about capturing Osama bin Laden. It's about, beyond that, increasing dramatically our safety and getting rid of terrorism, getting rid of this evil in the world. And what worries me as a former government official in charge of a big bureaucracy, government bureaucracies at best don't work terribly well. They work well when the government is responding to a public that understands specifically what that bureaucracy is trying to do. And I don't know that the public does know, understand very specifically,
but
in terms of that Powell Doctrine, what is trying to be achieved here.
But do we have a choice? The threat is shadowy. It's in itself ambiguous. Is there an alternative?
Well, if we take the kinds of specific goals that were articulated just now in terms of Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network and Afghanistan, and those are the three goals, those are understandable. But if we go beyond that and say, well, maybe we have to go into Iraq because Iraq has some relationship with germ warfare and there's some probability that Iraq was doing this and that with regard to Osama bin Laden. Maybe we have to go to Somalia. Maybe we have to do something in Sudan because the network extends over there. There's no necessary end to all this. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld wrote in September 27th that forget about exit strategies, he said. We're looking at a sustained engagement that carries no deadline.
And there it is.
Well, what are we to make of that?
What are we to make of it? We've been trained as Americans to expect, almost demand an exit strategy. Now we've got, we're told, a different kind of war, and there is no exit point specifically demarcated here. How do you feel about it? Let us know at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Is it the right thing? Do we have a choice? Can we expect an exit strategy anymore? We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's turn to them now. Eric is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Eric.
Welcome.
Hi, good to have you.
Thank you. So what is the question here? Do you want me to comment?
Yeah, what's on your mind? Do you need an exit strategy in this war on terrorism, Eric?
Well, coming back to the idea of measure of success, I think it's important to realize that You're taking on this kind of a war, and it's not much different than the war on drugs. You know, you're talking about eliminating terrorism, and that's something that is going to exist in our society, unfortunately, in one way or another. But in terms of the measure of success, in order for us to get out of this, I think that's going to be defined as we go along. I don't think anyone should be naive enough to think that we know what the point is going to be, and I think that the trick is going to be to get out of there at a time when we can define some level of success and then really evaluate our foreign policy and say, well, you know, what brought this about, and if it's our relationship to Israel, how do we gracefully deal with our relationship with Israel and still acknowledge what seems to have been a turning point in our foreign policy and in our administrations over the years, that we finally seem to have been, before the September 11th bombings, acknowledging the Palestinian cause and acknowledging that there needs to be some kind of resolution, and recognize that the Norwegians brought the Oslo Accord to a point that can be brought back again, and let's try and do something that's going to change our image in the Middle East. And without greatly changing our relationship with Israel, there must be a graceful way to deal with that. And I think, you know, you pull out, you define your victory, and then you try and deal with, as hard as it is to say, some of the concerns that led to the September 11th bombings. I mean,
got it. We got it, Eric. We got your point, and it's a big, broad one. Let me put it to John Lynn, and thanks for your call. John Lynn, Eric is, first of all, interestingly, comparing this to the war on drugs. There's been a series of wars that were more rhetorical than military, war on drugs, war on poverty, and so on. Do you think that's the right way of characterizing it? And then he takes it up a notch, beyond the military, to the larger elements here, maybe Israel, maybe it's U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, and so on. Do you think that's fair to put it in the same category as the war on drugs? And when can we expect to move from the military engagement to this underlying issues, or will that be simultaneous over time?
First of all, I don't think that we learn a lot by comparing it with the war on drugs. We're not fighting our daughters and children here. If we were fighting the war on drugs like the way we're fighting this war, we would be in Colombia right now. I don't think there's any clear analogy. My favorite non-analogy is Vietnam, but the war on drugs is another of my favorite non-analogies. Look, whatever we do, again, I think it's going to be pulsating. It's not going to be this constant thing. We won here, so let's now go off to Iraq kind of thing. But we have to have both short-term, medium, and long-term, you know, strategies. And I think one of them is to reconsider some of the things that we've been doing in the Middle East. I hate to do it because bin Laden got our attention, but I personally feel that the sanctions against Iraq may be counterproductive at this time, particularly in view of the Islamic world. I think that our policy towards the Palestinians has long needed to be to be reevaluated. And I also feel that if indeed the Islamic world is that concerned, not just a few extremists, about the number of troops that we have in Saudi Arabia, there's other things to do with those troops. But if we do those immediately, we're going to look like we've just been defeated, that terrorism really works in the United States. Now, there's other things that
so
we...
So it's peace with honor, is that it?
Well, peace with honor. I mean, peace with honor is an old term for continuing to do what you damn well want to do. I mean, I think in this case, we really do have to give a lot more attention to Middle East and Southwest Asian and Central Asian policy. That's a long-term thing and will have a long-term effect. But in the short term, I don't think that any change in policy is going to change the threat we're faced with right now, because those people are already committed.
And John Lynn, let me ask you, you've studied and you're writing about, or have just written about, the history of war and culture. Do you see in the American culture a precedent or a readiness to stick with this over the very long term, after the shock of September 11th begins to recede, after some of the flags begin to come down? This hasn't been the pattern in most of our lifetimes. Do you see it now as a realistic possibility, that kind of long-term duration, stick-with-it attitude?
Well, as I've said before, again, the key to me here is really pulsating. The fact that, yes, you're going to have spikes of patriotic feeling, but to the extent that terrorism remains an effective threat and carries out effective actions against the United States, you're going to have resurgences and reinforcements of that patriotism. History both gives us parallels, yes, and things we can look back to, but also, you know, one of the lessons of history is that every new situation is in some way unique, and this one, I think, really is unique. There's much to learn from the past, but one of those things is indeed that we don't walk the same path twice.
We're in a new situation. Can we live without endpoints to this war? Do we have a choice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Imran is on the line. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, what I want to kind of make the point about is that if this is an open-ended war and there's a real no bright line test as to what's going to measure a real success, what I wonder about is, you know, if we continue the bombing, we continue to increase the suffering of people in various countries as we decide to go from country to country looking for terrorists and bombing those countries, we start to increase the likelihood of creating more terrorists. And as that potentiality comes back at America, I wonder if as more casualties start to pile up on American soil because of terrorist activities, will that be kind of the clarion call to basically say, hey, we really need a sea change in our foreign policy, mm-hmm. and it's time that we address this serious these issues seriously instead of just paying lip service to local regimes?
Imran, it's an interesting question. Let's put it to Robert Reich. If, in fact, we get the kind of pulsing effect that that John Lynn is talking about, and we have our attacks and we have responses and then we attack again and losses begin to mount out there and back here, Robert Reich, how do you see that playing out in American culture?
Well, I wish I could be as optimistic as both the caller and also John Lynn about the ability of this culture to say, well, maybe we ought to do it completely differently. Maybe we ought to try a different strategy. Maybe we ought to completely revamp our foreign policy. In fact, if history teaches us anything, it's that when the military and military bureaucracies and the military way of thinking and all of the investments that go into the military machine gets going, it's very difficult to pull out unless, even with clear-cut objectives. If there are not clear-cut objectives, if the public simply is told, give us a blank slate, let us do as long as we want what we want and root out terrorism, whatever that means, without clarifying it, it's going to be very hard to ever pull back unless there is a colossal defeat, unless we get to a point where we are exhausted, we face a set of losses that are so incalculable that we just have to reassess and reevaluate.
But maybe, Robert Reich, this is the price of living in an inequitable, angry in many quarters, globalized world. Maybe this heightened sense of security and on our toes, even war footing, is the price we have to pay.
Well, but then let's talk about it clearly and objectively in those terms. Let's have the president and our leadership in general say to the American public, we are going to have to face the reality of a world of terrorism. We're going to have to adapt the way we live. We're going to have to change and reassess our foreign policies with regard to Israel and the Middle East. We're going to have to think more clearly about issues of equity. In other words, a much broader canvas. Right now, there is no thinking at all.
Well, you may or may not agree with that, listeners. We certainly have not had the whole story laid out yet. But we're talking about, now that we're into this war, how do we think about getting out of it? Can we think about an endpoint? Can we think about an exit strategy? Join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Now that we're in this war, we're thinking about how we might ever get out of it. Can there be an endpoint? Can there be, must there be, an exit strategy? Or is that old-fashioned thinking no longer possible? We're talking tonight with John Lynn, professor of military history at the University of Illinois, and with Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Warren is calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Warren. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'd like to bring this sort of a little broader, and what concerned me, I remember the first day, the first thing that came that I thought about, I'm an archaeologist and working in Mexico with civilizations, and mm-hmm. I immediately thought, you know, could this be the end of the American Republic? Could this be one of those points that if we don't have an exit strategy, if we have a long-term commitment, is it enough to ask for special powers and for a real change in our national policy? To
Warren, you're an archaeologist. When an archaeologist asks if it's the end of the republic, we really want to know what you mean. What you're saying, because we've been attacked or because we're at war?
Sort of neither. That this becomes in itself. There's so much enthusiasm that this is so important that we change things, basic things about the structure of the Constitution and the structure of. There's been major concern about how does this affect the Bill of Rights? How does this affect our exchange security for our basic freedoms? I mean, well beyond the need for the right to pursue happiness. You know?
Well, we're not looking to go the way of ancient Rome here, Robert Reich. and Warren, thank you for your call. But, you know, here's an archaeologist who looks at this and sees a big point in history. I think we all feel that.
Well, certainly the question is, are we prepared to become almost a permanent war economy, almost a permanent war society, a society at war, as some of our leaders have said, decades from now, without knowing precisely what we are trying to accomplish every step along the way? It might be, I can see the American public being patient if there were specific objectives that we could say, as we achieve them, we are then going to go to the next objective. This requires patience, but you can mark our progress along a scale. But it's hard to imagine patience over decades for a permanent war footing.
John Lynn?
I mean, you know, we're acting as if this never happened before. We fought a war in Korea, which, by the way, you know, we are still patrolling that frontier. Mm-hmm. We didn't predict the way that war was going to end. It came as a rather unsatisfying end for the American people, and the Koreans still haven't signed a peace treaty. Mm-hmm. That was a key move in a Cold War, which put us on a war footing for a long time. We had the patience. We didn't have a specific idea of how that was all going to work out. Jesus, people didn't predict the fall of the Soviet Union until it actually happened.
But John Lynn, we did in Korea, have a specific goal in mind. We knew what we wanted to do. Douglas MacArthur had a slightly different idea than Harry Truman. And in Vietnam, even though we got mired there, we had an articulated goal. Most of the wars that we have been in history have had to do with territory or containment. They've had geographic objectives. They've had particularly administrative objectives. But here we have something that is quite different. We're dealing with almost an intangible objective.
I agree. I agree very much that it's different, and that's one of the things I've been trying to say. I also feel, though, to say that we've never been in a situation which has been kind of open-ended and called for a military response over a generation. No, we've had that, and that was called the Cold War. And you're right. I mean, it was different challenges and different objectives. I keep coming back to this notion as if somehow we chose for this to happen. No, I mean, you can argue that if we changed policy ages ago, things would have been different, but it hasn't. And while we're faced with a situation, and I think we have to manage it the best we can. I agree with you entirely that this shouldn't be the first stage in a series of constant wars of this kind. Whenever the Air Force takes over, I break out in a sweat. I think, you know, we have got to deal with force, but with appropriate force. And right now, I think, you know, that gentleman from the ex-Special Forces fellow had, you know, very good, as it were, short-term what we want to do in Afghanistan, although I'm terribly worried about the impact of that in Pakistan, as your first visitor tonight said. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we're totally without precedent, and I don't think we're totally, you know, incapable of making reasonable choices and reasonable long-term actions in a threat environment.
John Lynn, thanks very much for joining us this evening. It's been great having you.
My pleasure.
John Lynn teaches military history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Robert Reich, last thought. Maybe we're just waiting for the curtains to be parted on the fuller policy that the Bush administration may present here, beyond just the military moves in Afghanistan.
Let's hope so, Tom. It may be that there's an opportunity in the next weeks or months for the administration to be more specific about what it wants to accomplish, perhaps crippling al-Qaeda, going after bin Laden, capturing him, stabilizing Afghanistan. That is stage one.
Thanks for joining us tonight, Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, our guest special coverage news analyst this evening. You can continue this conversation online at WBOR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Each night this week, we're looking at the literature of and about Afghanistan. What can poets and storytellers teach us about the Afghan people and their character? Today's installment, the classical literature of Afghanistan.
The Juyi Mulyan we call to mind. We long for those dear friends long left behind. The sand of Uxus, toilsome though they be, beneath my feet were soft as silk to me. Glad at the friends return the Uxus deep, up to our girth in laughing wave shall leap. Long live Bukhara, be thou of good cheer, joyous towards thee hasteth our Amir. The moon's the prince, Bukhara is the sky. O sky, the moon shall light thee by and by. Bukhara is the mead, the sire is he. Receive at last, O mead, thy cypress tree.
The Afghan poet Rudaki wrote that ode to his homeland sometime around 900 AD. Rudaki is first in a line of classical Afghan literary artists who wrote from the 10th to 13th centuries. Their poems and stories are still recited by Afghans today. Why do they endure, and what do they say about contemporary Afghanistan? We're joined by William Beeman, professor of anthropology and Middle Eastern studies at Brown University. Welcome, William Beeman.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we just heard a bit of Rudaki. Tell us what to make of that and give us some interpretation.
Rudaki was almost the very first poet to write in modern Persian. And it's important to note that he lived in the 10th century. He died in 940 AD. And his poetry is completely understandable by people who speak modern Persian or Dari or Tajik, one of the varieties that we have of modern Persian. And this poem, in legend, was supposedly recited to the then king that he served under, who was living in the city of Herat in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
The seat of government was Bukhara, and the king had abandoned Bukhara for the pleasures of Herat. And the people of Bukhara were getting a little upset because there were potholes in the streets. And so they hired Rudaki to go to the emir and to persuade him to come back. And he recited this poem in which there are all these images about the emir being the moon and Bukhara being the sky and the emir lighting up the sky with his brilliance. And supposedly he was so completely taken with this imagery that he jumped onto his horse without even putting on his boots and rode straight back to Bukhara. And supposedly the people of Bukhara were very grateful and rewarded Rudaki for his eloquence.
So this speaks perhaps to the perceived power of art in Afghan cultural history.
No question that poetry has been revered in Afghanistan and in the surrounding areas for centuries and centuries, more than 1,000 years. And the fact that the language has been so conservative that people today can read it with great pleasure and, in fact, memorize these verses. The verse that you heard from Rudaki is something that, honestly, every school child knows.
Today, we think, rightly or wrongly, of Afghanistan as a rough, rugged outback, but I hear you describing it as a kind of cultural center. Who were the big pillars there?
Well, you have to understand that from the 9th century to the 14th century, this area of Afghanistan was probably the cultural center for all of the Middle East. The great scientists and poets were there, and some of the greatest were Rudaki, who we've mentioned, and coming on later, Ferdowsi, who wrote the great epic poem, the Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, mm-hmm. in the beginning of the 11th century. And finally, Jalal al-Din Rumi, known as Rumi here in the United States, who lived a little bit later in the 13th century.
When you look at Rudaki, Ferdowsi, and Rumi, are there Western literary figures that they might be comparable to in their standing there?
Well, I think of the great epic poets like Homer or Dante or Milton. Certainly their stature in the Middle East is as great as these poets are in the West. And to be honest with you, their stature is well deserved.
So can you distill some of the primary cultural values that are embedded in these works for us as we look at Afghan society today? What comes down through the ages through this literature?
One of the things about Ferdowsi in particular is that it is both a heroic and a romantic tradition, so that we have great poetry that deals with battle and heroism in battle and nobility, but at the same time, they're great love stories. of tremendous passion between figures that are very important. And in fact, the high point of the Shahnameh is the battle between the great hero Rustam and his son Sohrab. They were separated when Sohrab was young, and Sohrab went over to the other side, and they end up fighting each other in battle, and Rustam kills his own son and only realizes after his son is dying.
So the passion is there. What other great cultural tradition or values do we see reflected?
Well, if we move to some of the other poets, particularly Rumi, we see that these poets embody also a mystical Islamic tradition, a Sufi tradition. There is no question that Rumi's poetry tries to explore the inner life and the search for the absolute, the search for God. And he uses tremendously powerful metaphors. One of the more hackneyed metaphor is the metaphor of the moth and the flame. And we think of the moth and the flame as a metaphor that has to do with maybe some kind of tawdry romantic attachment. But for Rumi, the secular love, that is the love of another person in a romantic sense, was a metaphor for a love of God. Mm-hmm. And the moth, as the moth approaches the flame, it's the same as the human being who desires a union with God, approaching that which is ineffable and all-powerful.
If you sit back and look at the terrain of classical Western literature and then shift and look at this classical Persian literature, I guess, are there marked differences that come to mind in looking at this cultural bedrock?
I think that in the West, we have tended to develop poetry as an aesthetic exercise completely abstracted from the rest of society. Mm-hmm. In the Middle East, in these poetic traditions, they almost always have a larger purpose. They either are designed, as in the epic tradition of Ferdowsi, to stir feelings of patriotism, nationalism, some of the higher emotions, I guess one would say, or they are, in the Sufi tradition, designed to instruct.
I was swept away by the passion and mysticism of Rumi's poetry, but he can also be very practical sometimes. I saw a few verses. He said, "Whoever acts with respect will get respect. Whoever brings sweetness will be served almond cake."
That's true. In fact, there's quite a lot of humor in Rumi as well. Many, many jokes, some of which have a mystical meaning. For instance, the story that some of your listeners may know from another source, where Juha, the wise fool, is looking for something, and his friend comes up and says, "What are you looking for?" And he says, "I dropped a coin," and his friend helps him look for a while. And he says, "Well, but I can't find it. Where did you drop it?" And Juha says, "Well, in the house." And his friend says, "Why are you looking for it here?" And Juha says, "Ah, the light is better here." And what Rumi means, of course, is that the light of enlightenment, or the light of God, is where you need to look for truth.
It may not be where you drop the coin, but it may be where
you drop the coin at all.
It may be where you find the answer.
That's correct.
William Beeman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
William Beeman is professor of anthropology and Middle East studies at Brown University. We'll continue our Afghan literature series tomorrow night with a discussion on war as a theme in contemporary Afghan writing. For extensive coverage of the war on terrorism online, go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR, Boston.